Near Eastern monarch to his subjects. And he imposes his authority and his will upon his subjects from above by power, whether it be physical power or spiritual power. And so it is thus that in the, say, the Anglican Church, when the priest at morning prayer addresses the throne of grace, he says, Almighty and everlasting God, King of kings, Lord of lords, the only ruler of princes, who dost from thy throne behold all the dwellers upon earth, most heartily we beseech thee with thy favour to behold our sovereign majesty Elizabeth the Queen and all the royal family. Now, what are these words? This is the language of court flattery. And the title King of Kings, as a title of God, was borrowed from the Persian emperors. The Cyrus of Persia, the Kyrios, hence Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy upon us, is a kind of image drawn from things earthly and applied to things heavenly. God as the monarch. And therefore, between the monarch and the subject, there is a certain essential difference of kind, what we might call an ontological difference, so that God is God, and all those creatures, whether angels or men or other kinds of existence which God has created, are not God. There is this vast metaphysical gulf lying between the two domains. That gives us, as citizens of the United States, some problems. Because, as a citizen of the United States, you have believed, and do believe, that a republic is the best form of government. How can this be maintained if the government of the universe is a monarchy? For surely, in that case, a monarchy will be the best form of government. And many of the conflicts in our society arise from the fact that although we are running a republic, many of the members of this republic believe, or believe that they ought to believe, that the universe is a monarchy. And therefore, they are above all insistent upon obedience to law and order. If there should be democracy in the kingdom of God, that would seem to them the most subversive idea ever conceived. Now, I'm exaggerating this standpoint a little bit, just for effect, because there are some subtle modifications which one can introduce theologically, but I won't go into them at the moment. Now, there are at least two other models of the universe which have been highly influential in human history. One is dramatic, where God is not the skillful maker of the world, standing above it as its artificer and king, but where God is the actor of the world, as an actor of a stage play, the actor who is playing all the parts at once. And this is essentially the Hindu model of the universe. Everybody is God in a mask. And of course, as you know, our own word, person, is from the Latin per sona, that through which comes sound. And this word was used for the masks worn by actors in the Greco-Roman theater, which being an open-air theater required a projection of the voice, so the actors wore masks with megaphonic mouths. And so the word person has, however, in the course of time, come to mean the real you. There was a very serious mistake made in translation from Greek to Latin when one began to talk about the three persons of the Holy Trinity. The three masks of God wasn't quite the right idea, because the Greek word was hypostasis, not a word prosopon, which would have meant properly translated person. Hypostasis is a very difficult word to translate. You could say that ice, water, and steam were three hypostases of the same thing. And that would be a little better analogy, not too good. But in Hindu thought, every individual as a person is a mask, but fundamentally a mask of the Godhead. A mask of a Godhead who, although the actor behind all parts, the player of all games, is indefinable for the same reason that you can't bite your own teeth. For the same reason that you can't look straight into your own eyes. You can never get at it because it's the middle of everything. The circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. Then a third model of the universe, which is characteristically Chinese, is that the world is an organism. And a world which is an organism has no boss, even no actor. Because you see, in any organism, there isn't really a boss or top organ. We are accustomed, of course, in our culture, to think of our heads as ruling the rest of the body. But there could well be an argument about this. I'm going to put up a case that the stomach is chief. Because the stomach, the sort of alimentary tract with a digesting process in it, is surely anterior to brains. There may be some sort of rudimentary nervous system attached to a stomach organization. But it's the more primitive you get, the more you get a little creature that eats. See? It's a sort of tube. And in go things at one end and out the other. And that because that wears the tube finds means of reproducing itself to make more tubes, so that this process of in and out can be kept up. But in the course of evolution, at one end of the tube is developed a ganglion, which eventually develops eyes and ears and has a brain in it. The better to scrounge around for food. And so the stomach point of view is that the brain is the servant of the stomach to help it scrounge around for food. But the other argument is this. True, the brain is a later development than the alimentary tract. But the alimentary tract is to the brain as John the Baptist to Jesus Christ, the forerunner of the big event. And the reason for all this scrounging around and stomach and stuff is eventually to evolve a brain. And man shall eventually live primarily for the concerns of the brain, that is, for art and science and all forms of culture, and the stomach shall be servant. Now, cynical people like dialectical materialists say that's a lot of hogwash. It's really all history is a matter of economics, and that's a matter of the stomach. It's a big argument, and you can't decide it. Because you can't, at this stage, have a stomach without a brain or a brain without a stomach. They go together like a back and a front. So the principle of organism is rather like this. An organism is a system of a differentiated system, but it has no parts. That is to say, the heart is not a part of the body in the sense that a distributor is part of an automobile engine. Because although surgeons are trying to treat the body as a machine with replaceable parts. They're having great difficulty doing this. They may succeed one of these days. But the difficulty is that these are not parts in the sense that they are screwed in. In other words, when the fetus arises in the womb, there are not a lot of mechanics in there who are lugging in hearts and stomachs and things and fitting them together and screwing them to each other. An organism develops like a crystal in solution or a photographic plate in chemicals. It develops all over at once. And there isn't a boss in it. Because all of them act together in a strange way. It's a kind of orderly anarchy. And this is the Chinese view of the world, fundamentally. This principle of organic growth they call Dao. That's pronounced Dao. If it had an apostrophe after it, it would be pronounced Tao. But Dao is more or less the right pronunciation for that word. This Chinese word is usually translated the course of nature, or the way. The way it does it. The process of things. And that again, you see, is really very different from the Western idea of God the ruler. Of the Tao, Lao Tzu says, the great Tao flows everywhere, both to the left and to the right. It loves and nourishes all things, but does not lord it over them. And when merits are accomplished, it lays no claim to them. And so the Chinese expression for nature becomes a word which we will translate self-self. Or zi-lian. What happens of itself? Like when you have hiccups. You don't plan to have hiccups, it just happens. When your heart beats, you don't plan it, it happens of itself. When you breathe, you can pretend that you are breathing, but most of the time you're not thinking about it, and your lungs breathe of themselves. So the whole idea of nature is something happening of itself without a governor, is the organic theory of the world. So you see, we have these two others, the dramatic theory and the organic theory. And therefore, I feel that ways of life which use these models are so unlike Christianity, Judaism, or Islam that we cannot really use the word religion of these things. Now, what is there in Western culture that resembles the concerns of Buddhism and Hinduism and Taoism? Because the trouble is, from the outside, they look alike. In other words, you go into a Hindu temple, or especially a Japanese Buddhist temple, and you'll be pretty convinced you're in church, in sort of a Catholic church at that, because there's incense, chants, bowings, gongs, candles, rosaries, and all the things that one associates with a theistic, monarchical religion. And yet, that isn't what's going on. There isn't the factor of obedience. Even though the image of Buddha may be sitting on a throne, covered with a canopy, and royal honors being done, there's still something different. Well, I suppose that at a long shot, probably the nearest thing to these ways of life in the West is perhaps psychotherapy in some form. Not all forms of psychotherapy. Because the objective of psychotherapy is, as you might say, to change where your head's at. Is to change your state of consciousness. If you, in other words, you are horribly depressed, if you are terrified, if you're under hallucinations, you see a head shrinker. And he tries to change your state of consciousness. And so, fundamentally, these disciplines, these oriental ways, are concerned, basically, with changing your state of consciousness. Only, here we part company. Psychotherapy is largely focused on the problems of the individual as such. The problems peculiar to this individual or that individual. These Asian ways of life are focused on certain problems peculiar to man as such, to every individual. On the understanding that the average human being, and the more civilized he is, the more this is true, that the average human being is hallucinating. That he has a delusive sense of his own existence. And it is thus that the very word Buddha in Buddhism is from a root in Sanskrit, bud, which means to awake, to awaken. To awaken from the illusion is then to undergo a radical change of consciousness with regard to one's own existence. It is to cease being under the impression that you are just poor little me. To find out who you really are, or what you really are, behind the mask.
Your It continues with Session 12, The Veil of Thoughts.
The subject of this seminar is the veil of thoughts. And following out the theme that somebody once suggested by saying that thought is a means of concealing truth, despite the fact that it's an extraordinarily useful faculty. But in quite recent weeks, we've had an astounding example of the way mankind can be bamboozled by thoughts. There was a crisis about gold, and the confusion of money in any form whatsoever with wealth is one of the major problems from which civilization is suffering. Because way back in our development, when we first began to use symbols to represent the events of the physical world, we found this such an ingenious device that we became completely fascinated with it. And in ever so many different dimensions of life, we are living in a state of total confusion between symbol and reality. And the real reason why in our world today, where there is no technical reason whatsoever why there should be any poverty at all, the reason it still exists is people keep asking the question, where's the money going to come from? Not realizing that money doesn't come from anywhere and never did, except if you thought it was gold. And then, of course, if to increase the supply of gold and use that to finance all the world's commerce, prosperity would depend not upon finding new processes for growing food in vast quantities, or getting nutrition out of the ocean, or getting water from atomic energy. No, it depends on discovering a new gold mine. And you can see what a nonsensical state of affairs that is. Because when gold is used for money, it becomes, in fact, useless. Gold is very useful metal for filling teeth, making jewelry, and maybe covering the dome of the Capitol in Washington. But the moment it is locked up in vaults in the form of ingots, it becomes completely useless. It becomes a false security. Something that people cling to, like an idol, like a belief in some kind of big daddy or god with whiskers who lives above the clouds. And all that kind of thing diverts our attention from reality. And we go through all sorts of weird rituals and get in the symbol, in other words, gets in the way of a practical life. So it was, you remember the Great Depression. I expect a number of you here looking around are old enough to remember the Great Depression, when one day everybody was doing business and things were going along pretty well, and the next day there were bread lines. It was like someone came to work and they said to him, "Sorry, chum, but you can't build today. No building can go on. We don't have enough inches." He said, "What do you mean we don't have enough inches? We got wood, haven't we? We got metal, we even got tape measures." He said, "Yeah, but you don't understand the business world. We just haven't got enough inches, just plain inches. We've used too much of them." And that's exactly what happened. when we had the Depression. Because money is something of the same order of reality as inches, grams,